As a doctor, I have never believed in ghosts, at least not the visible kind. I will admit I have even mocked those who were taken in by vaporous apparitions impersonating the dead, conjured by mediums and designed to titillate the gullible. My friend Sherlock Holmes stood even firmer on the topic. As a man who relied on solid evidence and scientific reasoning, he saw no proof of their existence. And to speak frankly, to a detective, ghosts fulfill no purpose. Without a corporeal perpetrator, justice cannot be served. But hard on the heels of the diabolical and terrifying affair of the Hound of the Baskervilles, which I recount elsewhere, our disbelief in the supernatural was put to a terrifying test. One might always expect my friend's rational and scientific approach to triumph, yet some aspects of the strange and weird tale I call unquiet spirits defy explanation, and there are pieces of this puzzle that trouble me to this day. Holmes forbade publication of these events until 50 years after his death, and I believe his reasons were due less to any momentary lapse on the subject of ghosts than they were to the revelation of facts concerning Holmes's last days at university. Thus, I defer to my friend's wishes and hope those who are reading this account at some unknown future date will understand and grant us both the benefit of a kindly regard on the actions we took and did not take in Scotland in the winter of 1889. It had been a year filled with remarkable adventures for us, culminating in the recent terrifying encounter with the Baskervilles and the aforementioned spectral hound. Back in London afterwards, with the great metropolis bustling about us in the noisy pursuit of commerce, progress, science and industry, the dark occurrences of Dartmoor seemed a distant nightmare. It was a late afternoon in December, and the coldest winter of recent memory was full upon us. A dense white fog and the promise of snow had settled over the streets of London, the chill penetrating to the bone. Mary had been called away once again to a friend's sickbed, and without her wifely comforts, I did not hesitate to return to visit my singular friend in our old haunts at 221B Baker Street, now occupied by him alone. My overcoat hung dripping in its usual place, and as I stood in our formerly shared quarters awaiting the appearance of Holmes, I thought fondly of my first days in this room. Just prior to first encountering Holmes, I had been in a sorry state. Discharged from the army, alone in London and short of funds, my nerves and health had been shattered by my recent service in Afghanistan. Of that ghastly campaign and its consequences, I have written elsewhere. The lingering effects of my wartime experiences had been threatening to get the better of me, but my new life with Holmes had sent those demons hurtling back into darkness. I stood, taking in the familiar sights. The homely clutter. Holmes's Stradivarius carelessly deposited in a corner. The alphabetized notebooks and files cramming the bookshelves, and found myself wondering about Holmes's own past. Despite our friendship, he had shared little of his early life with me. Yet I was certain Holmes had ghosts of his own. In Paris the previous year, the remarkable French artist Lautrec had called my friend a haunted man. But then artists see things that others do not. The rest of us require more time. A loud clanking noise drew me from my reverie. Off to one side on Holmes's chemistry table, a complex apparatus of tubes and flasks steamed and bubbled, shuddering in some kind of effort. I approached to examine it.
"Watson! How good of you to stop in!" exclaimed the familiar voice,
and I turned to see the thin figure of my friend bounding into the room in a burst of energy. He clapped me on the back with enthusiasm, drawing me away from the equipment and towards my old chair.
"Sit, Watson. Give me a moment."
He moved to the chemistry equipment and tightened a small clamp. The rattling subsided. Gratified by the result, he favoured me with a smile, then dropped into his usual chair opposite mine. Despite his typical pallor, he seemed unusually happy and relaxed, his tousled hair and purple dressing gown giving him a distinctly bohemian look. Holmes rooted for his pipe on a cluttered table nearby, stuck it in his mouth and lit it, tossing the match aside. It landed, still smouldering, on a stack of newspapers.